Welcome to World of DAS, a show for data enthusiasts. I'm your host, Warren Hoffman, CEO of Safegraph and GP of Flex Capital. For more conversations, videos, and transcripts, visit safegraph.com/podcasts. Hello, fellow data nerds. My guest today is Oren Kass. Oren is the founder and executive director of the think tank American Compass and the author of the book Once and Future Worker, A Vision for the Renewal of Work in America. Also, he has a great name, Oren. Welcome to World of DAS.
Always good to be talking with data nerds. I wish this was my day every day.
Now, this is a podcast, and we love to ask people about like statistics and data. And when people think of like economic statistics, they think of like GDP, per capita income, et cetera. What are the common economic stats you think are most overrated?
GDP, I think, is a good place to start. I think the thing about economic statistics is there's a huge, probably too harsh to call it a garbage in, garbage out problem, but we've somehow gone from what are very specific, technical, narrow data points that have value if you understand exactly what's in them and what they are and aren't good for, to using them as just these generic statements about the health of the country somehow. And so GDP is an obvious example of this, where it's an incredibly important measure. We should be paying close attention to it. But it does not in any meaningful way sort of present a comprehensive picture of how the economy is performing.
Is there a particular stat that you really like? Like, okay, this is the one we should all be tracking.
I don't think there's any one. If I had to pick one, it would be productivity. But I think importantly, and this is sort of the next catch, is one could say, well, productivity, that is basically GDP, right? Productivity times the number of people working gives you GDP. And that's exactly where the problem comes in. It's the first thing we do with our aggregate statistics is we divide them by the number of people and think that now we have a per person statistic, when in fact, that sort of translation from aggregate to personal totally obscures all of the variation that you have in the world. And I think with productivity in particular, you then also have the problem of obscuring all of the variation in types of work that people are doing. And so, for instance, there are some places where productivity data, I think, is actually quite good. When we actually look at per person input in a given manufacturing sector, we start to understand something important about whether we are getting better at making things, whether we are applying more capital and better processes to generate more output from the same labor. That is an incredibly important thing to understand. When you aggregate and aggregate and aggregate and declare it's a $24 trillion economy this year instead of a $23 trillion economy, you're in fact not necessarily saying anything at all about the actual prosperity of the typical family as a snapshot. And even more importantly, you're not really saying anything about the trajectory that we're on, whether the economy is actually producing progress in the way that we need it to.
American Compass put out this like cost of thriving index. And I guess one of the baseline assumptions of that is that it's just becoming more expensive to be middle class in general, like bigger houses, and we have different expectations than we did before. You're kind of like building in this lifestyle creep of everyone in the country. Do you think there's like a point of diminishing returns where like you just can't have that lifestyle creep forever? Or how do you think about that?
Yeah, cost of thriving index is one of my favorite projects that we do and is intended to be provided as a supplement to our typical inflation measures. So this is another classic place where inflation measures are incredibly important. There are people out there who are like, the inflation measures are wrong. They're lying to you. I certainly don't think that as a measure of does the same thing you bought last year cost more this year? It's very important to know what is happening to the price level. The problem is that in our economics and translating that into our political and policy discussions, we've taken that to be the end-all be-all of cost of living. So we've said, especially if you look over a longer period of time, let's say over the past generation, if nominal wages are up 25% and inflation is only up 23%, then that means you're better off, because you can buy more now than you could then. And again, that's important to know. You certainly want wages to be rising faster than prices. And a quick callback, the way that that happens is productivity growth. But it's not sufficient to say that if wages have risen faster than prices, then people are truly better off. And it is truly sort of easier to afford the things you need. And there are a few reasons for that. I think one, as you said, is lifestyle creep. And I want to talk more about that because I think that's, in a sense, the most interesting one. I do want to highlight just a couple of other things that are really important to keep in mind. One is that inflation measures are always quality adjusted. And so cars have way more whiz-bang features than they used to. And so you should expect it to cost more. And if you want to know what's happening to price levels in the economy, you want to correct for that. If you're a family trying to go out and buy a family car, unless you also still credibly have an option of buying the old one, then we have to acknowledge that buying a family car got more expensive in a way that an inflation measure won't and shouldn't. The other thing that I think is really important for folks to keep in mind and is really politically salient is something about insurance markets and health insurance in particular, which is that we very usefully risk pool. And we say, look, we're all going to pay in. And as health technology improves and we have more and better treatments for, frankly, a lot of times increasingly obscure conditions, that's a wonderful thing. But we have to recognize that if we have the $1 million treatment available for the 1 in 1,000 family that has a family member with a serious and rare condition, in the aggregate, again, we're all better off because we have access to that treatment. But if you're the 999 families that didn't need it, your health insurance premium just went up, and what you've actually consumed and how you would assess your quality of life hasn't changed at all. And so I think typically people will identify that as the key cost pressure. And it's important to understand that even as in the aggregate, we can celebrate the progress we've made, for your typical family, you know, what's the median amount a family is actually consuming in healthcare? It's not going up by that much at all. So those are examples of the sort of things that the economist isn't thinking about, but someone concerned about the well-being of Americans does need to think about.
How do you think about these things in local? When I lived in San Francisco, if you think of, let's say, 2011 to 2021, even though the rest of the country wasn't experiencing much inflation, like San Francisco had massive inflation. You saw all the key costs, restaurant costs were going up, labor costs were going up dramatically, costs for rent was going up dramatically, while the whole rest of the country started having lots of inflation post-2021, San Francisco actually had deflation. All those rent costs, all those other kind of costs started coming down. Labor costs started coming down. So there's all these like weird idiosyncrasies in the data too, right?
Yes, well, that's right. So there's certainly, and that's another form in which our aggregation gets things wrong, is geographically. And whether in GDP terms or, as you said, in inflation terms, people are experiencing very different economic conditions in different parts of the country a lot of times. To your point about something like labor costs in San Francisco or housing costs, it's also important to notice the different things we can mean by inflation. Because in some respects, if you say, well, demand for something has gone way up, so it's gotten more expensive, yes, that thing costs more, but that's not inflation in the same way that there's just more money chasing the same goods is inflation. And so those dynamics are very different. I think to your point, what someone was experiencing in San Francisco trying to make ends meet would not at all have been reflected in what a lot of the inflation data would say. We should be comfortable saying both are true, that the Fed's inflation measure for purposes of thinking about the money supply is one very important thing to know. And whether our economy is effectively supporting people in building a middle-class life is also important to know.
Now, how do you think about things like government transfers? Since the 70s, maybe income hasn't increased that much by itself, but then if you include things like government transfers, it may have increased a great deal. How do you start accounting for those types of things?
I think you just have to look at both. I think you have to recognize, on one hand, that government transfers have filled the gap for a lot of the ways I would say the economy has not been spreading prosperity widely. But also that is better than the alternative of not filling the gap, but it is much worse than the alternative of actually spreading prosperity broadly. And one thing, and this was back when I was doing my book a few years ago, what I found was maybe the most valuable chart that I sort of included on my presentations. It came from a New York Times report just looking at transfer payments as a share of income. So something government keeps very good data on is how much personal income is actually earned all the way down at the, let's say, you know, county level, versus how much of the income is being received through a government program.
Including things that aren't necessarily income, like food assistance and things like that.
That's right. And that's a huge spectrum from things that we'd say are real anti-poverty programs food stamps, welfare payments, all the way up to things like Social Security and Medicare. And what you see, if you go back to the 1970s and you sort of shade in every county by how much is transfers, you see it's pretty broadly nationwide around the 10% level, some areas up to 20%. You fast forward to the last decade, and some areas are still down at 10, 20%, particularly those sort of coastal urban hubs that have been generating tremendous wealth. And other parts of the country, you get these big red blotches kind of growing and spreading up to places where 40, 50% of the income in a county is actually transfer payments. And there are two ways of looking at that chart. If all you care about is consumption and material living standards, you technically look at that and you say, well, this is a triumph. This is, in a sense, what we signed up for. We said, all of the things we're going to do to maximize GDP, to, quote, grow the pie, these we know are not necessarily going to be equal, but we can always redistribute. We can collect taxes from the winners, send that money to the losers, and then everyone is better off. And from one perspective, if all you care about is maximizing consumption, then that has succeeded. I think it is empirically true that material well-being, living standards, consumption are everywhere, by geography, by income level, however you want to measure it. And yet we look at that chart, and I think virtually everyone has the reaction you just had. This is not what we wanted, and it can't possibly be good. We can be sort of making up for the failures in the economy, which is better than not making up for it. But we should also acknowledge that this is not good and it's not sustainable. It malforms the economy and the society in ways that people know are not good for themselves. It's not what people aspire to. And at the end of the day, if you say, well, you know, in the 1980s, you as a single wage earner could provide for your family. You could actually afford a healthcare premium. You could actually put your kid through college, et cetera. And today that's not true, but hey, that's okay because now we pay for your healthcare and we pay for your college. That's not the same thing. And people are right to say something incredibly important has been lost in that transition.
So it sounds like you're not necessarily like someone who'd be really in favor of a universal basic income.
No, definitely not. And I think for two reasons, both because from the perspective of the sort of recipients and the effect on the society, I think it's just a terribly broken model for human flourishing. But equally, I think it's important to see politically what it does for the winners. It is a get out of jail free card.
Yeah, it absolves you of any guilt, right?
To not have to think about what has actually happened. And I think saying that is not acceptable. You cannot write a check and redistribute cash to make up for lost social opportunity and equality of citizenship. In fact, the sacrifices that the winners are going to have to make are, in a sense, going to be a lot more costly than writing a check if we actually want to have a functioning democracy at the end of the day.
Now, the wealth inequality has gone up, let's say, since the 70s as well. The top 1% hold maybe about a third of the total wealth, though it's a bit misleading because I think the bottom 25% has negative wealth. What's the ideal wealth inequality number we should be shooting for?
I don't think there's an ideal. A brief digression. I think that's an important point generally, is I think particularly on the right of center or, you know, libertarian folks get very nervous about any of these sort of economic critiques. And they say sort of, oh yeah, well, you think you know what the right answer is somehow, right? And like, we can't have these government planners picking the numbers. And I totally agree with that. I think the idea that someone's going to come up with the right number for these things is not true and not a good model for policymaking. Whether the right metaphor is a dial or a pendulum, we are able, though, to perceive when something is wrong and when we need to go in a different direction. And to some extent, you'll always sort of be bouncing guardrail to guardrail, but it is important to our politics to be comfortable saying, this is not right and this is the direction we need to be course correcting in right now. And so I think that's certainly the case with wealth inequality today. I do think it's important to some extent. I at least am someone who care more about income than wealth. And the reason for that is that I think at the end of the day, it's important to recognize that most households are not going to save very much. That it's sort of simply a natural function of certainly a capitalist economy that your families in the middle are going to be pushed to spend most of what they earn. And so to say somehow that an ideal is that everybody is saving the way the wealthiest in the economy are saving doesn't really make sense. That being said, I think you should certainly want to see some capacity for saving. The optimal saving for your typical household is certainly above 0%.
Even just for insurance, for rainy day stuff, right?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. That's right. You should want to have a cushion. It also speaks to a sort of forward...
In case you lose your job, you could survive for a couple of months and, you know...
That's right. And it also speaks to a forward-looking orientation. You should have things you are saving for, in a sense. That's how I look at it today. It's not that there's some ideal percentage, but that we should aspire to a situation where the typical household is in a position to be saving... not just the $400 for the car breaking down, but to be saving toward retirement, to be saving toward actually putting kids through school or setting them up. Ideally, it's not that you're saving for expensive private college tuition necessarily, but that you are putting aside resources that the next generation are going to need to start building their lives. And so in all those ways, I think you see households under excessive economic pressure today relative to what a healthy economy, I think, would look like.
Now, I'd put you like on the new right, and where I see like the new right kind of differ from the traditional conservatives is you seem to have a much more supportive view of labor and unions. How is that evolving?
Well, I mean, the labor question is a fascinating one. And I think as you've described as sort of a new right view is exactly correct. I would say there are ways in which it is also the more traditional conservative view. And I always caution folks looking at our politics today to recognize that the sort of tax cut deregulation, free trade, union busting model of, say, the Republican Party is a sort of weird late 20th century anachronism in a lot of ways. That if you actually go back to the tradition of conservatism, concern for worker power used to be central to it. If you go back to Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, talks about the need for workers to be able to combine essentially because otherwise they will lose out against employers. John Stuart Mill explicitly, he questions the morals of anyone who would not support workers in combining forces and trying to claim as much as they can of the surplus from employers. And so what I think the new right is somewhat returning to is a recognition that markets on their own with no constraints or no concern for power are not necessarily going to spread prosperity broadly. That you actually need institutions within the markets, that you actually need to have a substantive view that we should want workers to do well and wages to be high for capitalism to work. And so that's where certainly my interest and I think a lot of the new right's interest in labor comes from. We are both comfortable saying organized labor as it works today in the US is incredibly dysfunctional, but then seeing the conclusion of that not being, so let's just cheer its demise, but rather let's try to figure out what could work.
And not really knowing this world that well, but the way I see kind of the differences between, let's say, the new right and the left on labor is it seems to be very supportive of things like the auto workers unions and other types of private sector employer unions, but they seem to be less supportive of government unions or teachers unions, other types of, is that correct?
Yeah, that's definitely right. And I think, again, going to the question of like, well, what's the traditional view? FDR was a staunch opponent of public sector unions too. If you take sort of the logic that I described for why the new right would be so interested in labor as sort of a countervailing force against private power and the power of employers or capital, that just doesn't apply in the public sector. The problem with public sector unions as they operate is that the fundamental rationale for their existence and the way that they're operating, I just find very confusing. Who is on the other side of the table? The other side of the table, if you're negotiating what police officers or teachers should be paid, isn't a private set of shareholders, it is the public as represented by their policymakers. And so I think any employee, public, private, should be entitled to representation. I think having some form of organization that represents public sector workers and can communicate their views in the workplace is fine. But the sort of robust collective bargaining that we want to have in the private sector, I don't think makes any sense in the public sector where we already have a democratic policymaking process that is supposed to manage those conflicts.
Now, we did a World of Desk podcast with Mary Kay Henry, the president of the Service Employees International Union. And I asked her if she saw any potential for new alliances between labor and the GOP. And she really shut that down. She really said she couldn't really see that happening, at least in this current climate. Do you think she's wrong? Do you think there will be these GOP-labor relationships?
Well, there definitely will be. And I think the key point of tension, and SEIU is a sort of quintessential illustration of this, is that unions as they are operating today, certainly at the kind of national level, are predominantly political operations. I mean, to be blunt, they are extensions of the Democratic Party. And if you think about what the SEIU does, the amount of money that it channels to trying to get Democrats elected is extraordinary. The set of policy issues that it focuses on, if you go to its website, is sort of the full spectrum range of progressive issues without respect to whether they have anything to do with the actual interests of workers in the workplace. And frankly, without respect to whether they actually represent the views of union members. One thing that has changed dramatically, and certainly more so on the private sector side, is that probably a majority of union members at this point are certainly not Democrats, and I would say probably are voting Republican, are Donald Trump supporters in a lot of cases. And that produces a really interesting tension. What is the role of someone like the head of the SEIU or the head of the AFL-CIO if most members, or even just a significant share, have totally different political views and preferences and priorities? And I think at this point, what you see is labor leaders still pushing very much the view of our job is basically to support Democrats. But that's not where union members are. And I think you're starting to see a lot of politicians on the right and organizations on the right build those direct relationships with union members, with union locals. And I don't know exactly where it goes from here, but that question of, well, what happens when the union no longer represents its members is a very live one right now, I think.
How do you think the tension between labor and innovation, how should we resolve that, whether it's like automation, AI, some of these other disruptive technologies that could destroy jobs? How do you think about that?
There's definitely a potential tension there. I think the flip side is that at the end of the day, we're right back where we started again on the issue of productivity. What I always emphasize is that all those forms of technology where the rubber meets the road on their connection to workers is that they enhance the productivity of the typical worker. And the other way of saying that is they, quote, destroy jobs. But destroying jobs and enhancing productivity are, at least in a static analysis, literally the same thing. You're talking about the number of hours of labor required to produce an output. And so in that respect, some new technology, automation, is literally the same thing as more training, right? No one says, well, you know, labor and training are in conflict because if you train workers and make them more productive, that's something they wouldn't want. Of course, it's something they do want. The reason that some of this sort of automation and technology tends to, I think, raise more of a problem and more conflict is because it's broadly understood and empirically has been the case that workers aren't sharing in the gains that that generates. That if you bring in automation so that a factory needs fewer workers and say, but guess what, each worker gets paid commensurately more, especially if you're in a growing economy with growing output, that's fantastic. That's the exact model that we saw in the middle of the last century where, you know, again, using manufacturing as an example, you had productivity growing at, say, 3% a year, but output was actually growing faster than that. So the formula was, look, each worker, you know, to be very abstract about it, each worker can produce twice as much, but the result is that the factory produces twice as much. We still need all the workers, and they can all be paid a lot more. What has gone wrong in, especially post-2000 in the era of globalization, is that when we see those continued productivity gains, we don't translate those to more output. We translate those into fewer workers. And we then translate the higher profitability of that, not even to higher wages for those fewer workers, but to higher profits for the shareholders. And labor quite reasonably says that that is not a deal that we're interested in. So I think there's absolutely a potential formula in which labor is aggressively pro-productivity gain, but it's only going to work in a situation where the corporate sector also understands that the premise here has to be growth in output and wages, not merely growth in profits.
It's hard to know how these things are going to play out, though. Like, I've seen some people in the new right come out for slowing things like self-driving trucks to protect the trucker jobs. Again, it could end up being really good for truckers. It could be really bad for truckers. It's very hard to know, and we might not know for 20 years. So like, okay, just in case we want to slow it. How do you think we should think about those things?
The trucker example is a great one, and it's one where I think there have been some folks who say, you know, hey, we have to like slow this or ban this. That has prompted some very active debates on the new right, because I would say most people recognize that's not the right answer. You could have a much longer sort of populism discussion, but there are very important and healthy forms of populism that say we need to take more seriously the concerns that have gone unattended to of typical people. And then there's the populism that sort of, let's say things that sound smart but aren't. And I think the like automation is bad, we should ban it, clearly falls in the latter category. But I think it returns right back to the prior question you had about labor, where in a world where workers have no power, and I think this was a lot of the concern about Uber when it was sort of first making inroads last decade, if you have a situation where you're introducing new technology and potentially disruptive technology, and there is no regulation or worker power to ensure that workers are protected and benefiting as well. And it's important to emphasize both. One of the reasons I think conservatives in the new right are so interested in worker power is because it's better than regulation. We would much rather have workers in a position to bargain with employers and work something out than decide the federal government's going to come in and figure something out. In a world where you have worker power, and using truckers as an example, in a world where truckers have some power and are well represented, then to your point, automation could be a great thing for truckers. In a world, and frankly, it is even much closer to the one we see now in the trucking industry, where truckers are used as sort of disposable commodities like crankshafts and carburetors. I don't even know if trucks still have crankshafts and carburetors, but let's say they do. In that world, then yeah, I certainly understand why truckers are concerned. And so much of what we do at American Compass and what the new right's economic thinking focuses on is exactly this sort of thing, which is how do we both recognize that progress in technology and growth are good and we want and need them, but get away from this sort of market fundamentalism of just trusting that they will automatically work out well. Because I think the left tends to err in sort of just thinking that capitalism and markets and growth, like these are bad and scary things. But the right has erred in its own right in being far too trusting of them. And where what I would call a much more traditional and useful conservative point of view can play a role is in saying, no, this is the path to prosperity, but there's also a lot of work that has to be done to make sure we are on that path.
When you think of the work from home stuff that started happening in COVID, on the one hand, that can be really good and empowering. All these people can get jobs, or it might be hard for them, or now they can take care of their kids. There's a lot of things they can do from home that they couldn't do before. You don't need a car, et cetera. On the other hand, once you have a lot of people work from home, it's a lot easier to export those jobs overseas. And really, well, you can have people anywhere doing those types of jobs. How do you see this tension as we're get more workers overseas to do things, whether it's software developers or data entry or accountants, or a lot of the kind of more traditional white collar jobs seem to be very easily exportable all over the world?
I mean, I think what it comes down to with globalization broadly is that for globalization to work, it has to be balanced. And starting with trade, and then you can sort of broaden out from there to any kind of service job that you could do remotely, but trade in goods is where it's most intuitive. The premise of trade benefiting everybody involved has always been that it's balanced. There are things that other people can make better or more efficiently than we can. There are things we can make better and more efficiently than they can. And if they make some of those and we make some of those and we trade them, we're all better off.
Yeah, certainly even in the U.S., there's certain areas of the U.S. that are really good at farming, certain areas that are good at making cars, and they kind of trade it in a way.
Right. Even in your own town, there's the plumber and the accountant. I mean, right, the basic case for specialization and exchange in an economy, that's great. The problem in globalization in recent decades is that we've moved to this very imbalanced form of it. And you see this in trade deficits, where a lot of things that we used to do and make here, people found ways to do and make cheaper elsewhere. but it wasn't exchanged for things that we could do and make here that other people wanted. It's always funny to ask, like, hey, what's the stuff that people are offshoring to America? And like, people are like, well, what? That doesn't make, like, what do you mean? It's like, well, technically, if globalization were working, there'd be all sorts of stuff that people were offshoring to America. And there are some now, especially given the U.S. energy renaissance, some extreme, like even some steel processes have come to America because we have such cheap natural gas. Obviously, on the services side, technically, the rest of the world has offshored its movie production to Hollywood. You do see some of it, but on balance, and especially in the traded goods sector and manufacturing, you've seen this massive offshoring away. It's a double-edged sword because on one hand, you're now making less. So like, yes, great, we get cheap stuff. We were talking about this earlier. If all you care about is consumption, maybe that's great. But you've greatly reduced your own industrial capacity, which is going to have huge implications for innovation and growth in the long run, not to mention jobs and social health in the short run and national security. And even worse, it's not that the rest of the world is sending us this stuff for free, right? What we trade back is assets. A current account deficit, meaning a trade deficit, is exactly offset by a capital account surplus. What we are sending back in return for all the stuff other people are making is debt and equity and real estate, basically ownership of our economy and IOUs. I think you're exactly right that there's a huge concern if this expands to the service sector, that just makes everything worse. If you start saying also other people are going to be the doctors and lawyers and computer programmers, and again, they're just going to do that for us and we're not going to do anything for anyone else. We're just going to even faster send back more debt and assets. That's a catastrophe. If it were actually balanced, if all sorts of things we used to be doing here could be done elsewhere, but just as to the same extent, that was opening up new opportunities for us to do stuff, more things we were going to make, more things we were good at doing, it could work out quite well. But that's the thing we've ignored and that we are going to have to find a way to get right, because the alternative, we're just, the American people are going to quite rationally say, shut it down. If we can't get it right, we're not going to do it. And certainly that leaves a lot of value on the table, but frankly, it would also be better than the imbalanced path we are headed down.
Now, when people ask Apple CEO Tim Cook about it, because they're a manufacturer in China, he says, we don't do it really because it's cheaper. They have super high quality, high precision industrial capacity. What do you think the big obstacles are if we really want to reshore some of these things?
I would say there are two huge categories. Well, actually, let me say three huge categories of obstacle. One is exactly what Tim Cook was describing, which is that we have claimed that this stuff doesn't matter for so long that we have lost the capacity to do it. And we have lost the broader supply chains and ecosystems.
It's not even like celebrated here. Like if someone wants to be really good at trade, it's not a celebrated thing. It's still like, oh, they should go get a liberal arts degree instead or something.
That's right. We don't culturally encourage it. We also don't economically encourage it. And that's sort of the second bucket, which is part of the reason so much of this stuff moved offshore is that other countries recognized its value and put massive investment and public support behind it, right? Like Taiwan does not have a comparative advantage in semiconductor fabrication. There's nothing about that rocky outcropping that makes it the best place in the world to fabricate semiconductors. That was a function of government policy. And so one piece is just from an expertise and ecosystem building perspective, we have allowed ourselves to fall behind and it is going to be costly to catch up and we have to do it. The second is that we have to be willing to make the same kinds of public investments to make it attractive here that other countries are doing. And again, you could say in an ideal world, maybe everyone agrees to disarm and not do that and just let the market work. But what you can't have is a world where everyone else is doing it and we are not.
When you think of these government policies, in some ways, if the government policymakers were competent, it could work. But if they are less competent, we have had a lot of government policy to spur industry with really mixed results and mostly not very great results in the U.S. Just because we want to have government policy to, let's say, have semiconductors in the United States doesn't mean like it's going to happen, right?
Maybe. I guess I would disagree with that insofar as I would say the things that the United States chose to focus on second half of the last century. I mean, if you were to say, what were the things we were really focused on? I'd say it was probably medical technology, microelectronics, and aerospace. Those are three areas where I would say the U.S. had essentially an industrial policy. And in those three, the U.S. became the dominant world leader. It actually worked quite well.
But you could also say, like, we had almost a policy against becoming energy independent, yet we still did it despite the policy in some ways.
And the funny thing about energy is that it is about natural resources. Energy and agriculture are the places where comparative advantage actually should function. And so to your point, America, essentially based on its shale formations, did have such an extraordinary opportunity there that even very bad government policy couldn't hold it down. You could say the same thing, whatever one thinks about our farm policy, America is an extraordinarily productive agricultural sector because we have the land and weather for that. But in those manufactured sectors, you know, taking semiconductors, the U.S. did become the dominant leader in semiconductors as a direct function of a wide variety of massive government policy and investment and prioritization. We did a case study at American Compass on this. Where did Silicon Valley come from? I mean, yes, it was very important to have the people in their garages innovating. But at the end of the day, virtually all of the funding that made it possible, both to develop those things and, as importantly, to scale them up and the supportive ecosystem to actually develop the modern computer industry, all of that was a function of public policy as well. And it's really interesting to compare something like semiconductors, where we were still in the 60s and 70s in a model of caring that we made it, to the sort of next technology of LCDs and flat screens and mobile devices that started coming online in the 80s and 90s. Those were all invented here as well. But we did not take seriously that we cared about being the place where they were scaled up. We did not make the investment. Others did. And that's where it went.
You don't think there's a correlation between the quality of the policymaker in the 60s or whatever versus the quality today?
There could be. I certainly think government capacity is a concern and we need to be doing better on it than we are. At the same time, it's not clear to me that we have worse policymakers than we did in the 70s. I haven't seen any good research on that. And I think it's also, again, interesting to still see that in those places where we decide we do want to do something, we often do it quite well. I mean, Operation Warp Speed is a quintessential example of this. And like, now you have folks with varying views on whether mRNA vaccines are good or not. Fine. But when the government decided that that was something we wanted to develop, and from a standstill to mass production on an unprecedented time frame, actually did it. And so I guess the last thing I would just say on this point is, it's really important here that we not let the perfect be the enemy of the good. There's a lot of argument, especially on the right, about, you know, government failure and what's called like public choice, the fact that incentives aren't perfectly aligned for policymakers and so forth. And that's all absolutely true. I'm not here to tell you that we should choose to do these things and we're going to implement these brilliant, flawless policies and it's all going to go great. But that's not the relevant standard. The question is, would doing this stuff be better than not doing it? And when we see the result of not doing it, and conversely, we see that many other governments with all of their failures, I mean, like, you know where it's hard to like do good government economic policy is inside like a communist party, right? Like, you want to talk about like public choice challenges, try like being in a communist party. And yet, at the end of the day, when you can identify, again, not like this is the startup that I want to invest my personal cash in, but hey, you know what? Semiconductors are important. And if that's the case, then people building big semiconductor fabs, we probably need to provide support to, especially insofar as the rest of the world is going to offer them support to do it there instead.
It used to be if like you want to be a barber or you want to be a massage therapist or you want to be a florist or something like that, you would work at another haircut place and you would occasionally watch the person cut the hair and you'd sweep the floors, you'd kind of learn the trade, then you'd kind of get up to like helping them a little bit and then you would start cutting someone else's hair and then maybe you eventually go like open your own place. Today, instead of that training being on the job, everyone outsources that training to schools. They're literally a school you go to learn how to cut hair and you go into debt to pay for this school. And then maybe the government helps you with that money, but you go into debt to pay for the school and then you eventually like even law, it used to be you'd intern in someone's law office and you'd help them and you'd probably sweep their floors and do a bunch of manual chores and a bunch of other things, but you'd kind of learn the trade. You wouldn't actually like spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on a school and go into debt. And then eventually you would get better. Why do we have to do like to school to learn these trades?
There's a social reason that it has become culturally normalized that pursuing formal education is sort of a good in and of itself, and you should pursue as much as possible. There's the sort of economic piece of it, which is that we basically created these open-ended subsidies to go get that kind of education, but nothing to get the on-the-job education. And then we also have all of the regulatory obstacles where we've then just gone and said, like, you must have this credential.
Yep, that's true. You must have to go to haircut school to cut people's hair. Yeah.
And so it's all of the above. And those are all mutually reinforcing. The more you have policymakers saying everyone should go to college and the more education, the better, and here's a bunch of money for it, the more that's going to be the cultural imperative, the more policymakers are then also going to want to create requirements to support that choice. You also obviously have professional associations promoting these kinds of barriers, which then creates the pressure for the subsidy. And you also then have the cultural value that demands the restriction. It all kind of goes around in a vicious cycle.
It just seems weird to me, like until, let's say, 50, 60 years ago, every course skill you'd learn on the job. And you'd start not glamorous. And so maybe it's just the fact that people don't like to sweep floors or something, but you'd have to sweep the floors. You'd have to do all these non-glamorous things. You might make extremely low wage doing that. You may not even get much of a wage beyond room and board or something back in the day, but at least you wouldn't go into debt trying to learn that. It feels like you would also probably learn a lot more. Like there's only so much someone could teach you about cutting hair in a school or something. It seems like you'd learn a lot more in a real live business.
Well, that's true. And I think that's also the case that there's an awful lot about work and doing a job that has nothing to do with the actual technical skill. I mean,
right. Showing up on time is hard and dealing with people and listening to things.
Absolutely. And one thing that you hear a lot about sort of like skills gaps these days. And, people say like, we want to do like advanced manufacturing and we can't hire people. Everyone always in their head, again, from this same cultural point of view, takes that to mean like, oh, we need more advanced robotics classes of some sort. You actually talk to the employers about it. What they mean is no, people who understand what it means to show up 40 hours a week for a job on time, passing drug tests. There are all sorts of other social issues at play, but it's not the technical skill. The one thing the employer is happy to do is, in a lot of cases, is help equip people with the technical skill. To your point, there's just been this shift in the society that takes this kind of formal educational path to be the one that is right for everybody and that should be the focus of the policy apparatus as well. I mean, you could write and read books and books about everything that went into it. I do think you see, though, just this remarkable sort of shift in 60s, 70s, roughly speaking, is when we sort of abandoned trade schools and tracking and so forth broadly. And a lot of it came out of the civil rights movement, where there were a lot of very sort of unfair ways that we did education, obviously. And the determination was made that sort of the correct way to do this is to ensure that everybody basically has the same opportunity to earn a college degree. And we had this college for all model. And then we tried to sort of wrap that into every profession, career, job. The share of jobs out in the world for which the correct preparation is hanging out on a leafy campus and sitting in a classroom all day is vanishingly small. And I think the good news is that after getting this so wrong, I do think most people have recognized it. When we do surveys, this is the issue where public opinion is most uniform. We ask people explicitly about tracking, like, hey, do you think we should have tracking in high schools? Middle class families, 95% say yes. And it doesn't matter whether you call it diverse pathways or just tracking. People are like, yes. You ask people whether they would rather have a three-year apprenticeship or a full ride at any college they can get into, parents even more so, and kids somewhat will say three-year apprenticeship. I think actually the politicians to some extent are the last ones to catch on to this, but I do think it's coming. It's one of the places I'm most optimistic for the next decade that we will actually see real reform in how things get done.
A few personal questions. I'm really interested in nominative determinism. And since we both share the same name, I'd be really interested to ask you how you think your name has or maybe has not affected your life.
I've never been asked that question. I guess I would enter with a fair degree of skepticism that it's been especially important. Maybe that's not true, but I guess I feel like it probably at the margin has some effect on first impressions and so forth.
I have learned that the median person named Oren is a millionaire, which is probably not true of the median, you know, David or something.
There are probably a few confounding variables in there that you would have to control for in your regression before I bond to that one too much. Me and you with our different spellings of it, I think you could do a really useful twin study on just people with different spellings of the name Oren.
All right. What is a conspiracy theory that you believe?
I tend to be very skeptical of conspiracy theories, mostly because I'm very skeptical of people's ability to conspire. And so I think typically...
Like to keep a secret in a way, or?
Keep a secret, execute complicated plans that pull off incredible things that no one thought possible. I think it's typically better explained by just everyone sort of going about pursuing their own interests and incentives. But in the spirit of the sort of off the wall or discrediting ideas, I will say I'm quite skeptical of most of modern science, especially physics.
It's like the replication problems and things like that, or?
There are replication problems. I mean, much more fundamentally, like quantum physics strikes me as almost entirely goofy and made up. Even our explanation of like electricity and electrons, I'm like, this seems like we probably don't really understand it at all and have like mashed on. I always like the example of the epicycles back before you had your heliocentric model of the solar system. People managed to construct sufficiently bizarre models of how the other planets circling within themselves as they circled the Earth sort of followed the patterns that were being observed. It seems to me we are wildly overconfident in the capacity of human intelligence to actually understand the universe. And what would be bizarre coincidence that at this exact moment in the early 21st century, we sort of suddenly really nailed it and just figured it all out. I think it's probably much more likely that things are far different than we understand them to be. And we are just, to this point, have achieved our latest kind of feeling different parts of the elephant gloss on reality.
When you decide to go into first principles on something, like I've never proved to myself that the world is round, but I just kind of accept it. I mean, it's possible someone later could like prove it that it isn't. I'm not going to first principles. I'm not like actually doing the core calculations. Maybe I did at some point in like college physics, but I've completely forgotten that. I just accept certain things, certain tenets of the world, but that could be bad. Like there could be points where you like you should go to first principles and really prove it for yourself. How do you know when to do that and when not to?
We have some pretty good pictures of the Earth where it looks round. So I think that helps as well. A lot of people are struggling within modern society today where there is so much expert guidance and so much that people aren't sure whether it's actually all that good. And certainly the experts have not covered themselves in glory in recent years. And so I guess there are two things. One is there's the sort of, where is a first approximation good enough? We clearly understand electricity well enough for the electricity grid to work. So I'm good with that. I'm going to pick my spots, obviously. I've, in my own work, chosen my one narrow place in areas of economic policy where I am determined to get to first principles and not just accept the approximations. But then I think the other place where it's really important and that we need to get better at and the public discourse needs to get better at engaging with is distinguishing the actual expert factual knowledge from the value judgment. We were sort of talking about this a bit right at the beginning where, you know, to what extent is the economic data factual versus embracing a number of value judgments and assumptions that are internally consistent, but if you don't accept that value judgment, then you shouldn't accept the conclusion either. And I think there are a lot of places where you can look at the assertion being made and disaggregate, okay, what if this is the actual fact that we know? And what if this is something you've just piled four value judgments on to reach your assessment or recommendation? And that's fine. You're not lying, but you actually are not an expert in any of those value judgments. And so I at least would like to understand what those are and or get back to the fact myself.
Yeah, you can say like the cancer surgeon is actually really good at being a cancer surgeon, but they may not be actually that great at helping society prevent getting cancer.
That's right. Or for that matter, assessing what risks and trade-offs people should make in their own lives as they expose themselves to carcinogens. And that's where people get so frustrated with the so-called tribalism of our politics. But to some extent, it's actually really important and unavoidable that people find others who they trust they share values with to trust in helping make those different types of decisions. Who are the experts in my life that I might turn to in thinking about what levels of risk are acceptable in the activities my family does? The public health person who understands exactly the epidemiological study on cancer rate is not someone whose opinion I'm especially interested in on that other question. But you also can't ask me to go figure out every one of those for myself. And so that's where I think really more faith in and embrace of a commitment to public social norms and moral judgments and values and communities that are going to kind of create a culture. I mean, this is what culture is, right? Like Taylor Swift isn't culture in a capital C sense. This is the stuff that culture is. And actually thinking about how to craft a healthy culture that lets people lead their lives is, I think, something we all need to get a lot better
at. Oh, this is great. The last question we ask all of our guests, what conventional wisdom or advice do you think is generally bad advice?
Well, to some extent, most conventional wisdom and advice is bad advice, because if that's what everybody else is doing, then there's some inherent value. I'm obviously something of a contrarian. But I will say, this is one that has become so cliche, it's almost cliche to point out that it's bad advice, but I will do it anyway, which is that there's the kind of follow your dreams model of career construction and life construction, which I think is obviously extraordinarily bad advice for the most part. I want to pair it, though, with the other extreme, which I see popular in some quarters, which is the sort of very effective altruism, just go and earn a tremendous amount of money and then like somehow use that money for good, which I think is equally bad. The sort of just follow your dreams model is bad advice because, first of all, your dreams may not, particularly as a profession, right? Like follow your dreams as an avocation and find hobbies you love. That's great. But building your professional life around the thing you love doing may not actually correlate to you ending up getting to do something you love doing at all. And thinking about that is very important.
But I know a guy who's fairly successful hedge fund person, he's like his early 30s, and he's thinking of quitting to become a full-time singer. I don't know. It just seems like that may not be the best. Yeah, you know, it might work and you might as well try it, I guess. You could always go back to the hedge fund world, but yeah.
You certainly see this academia as another quintessential example of this, where it's like, well, I really love blah, so I'm going to like get a PhD in that. But please at least ask yourself the next question of what will I actually be doing every day for the next 30 years if I pursue that course? And is that actually going to be the thing I love doing? Because it's probably not. The flip side with the effective altruism is there's a bizarre kicking the can down the road that I think we see in so much of our economic thinking generally, which is, well, I'm just going to create a lot of wealth and money, but then somehow somebody else is going to actually use that usefully. And this may seem bizarre, but is, I think, closely connected. This is the stock buyback problem. Okay, well, the company can't think of anything to do with its money, so it's just going to give it back to investors who will think of something better to do with it.
I know you're against stock buybacks. If a company does have extra money and they can't buy back their stock, they're usually either going to pay their executives more, mainly the CEO, or they're going to give dividends to the shareholders. That's usually the other alternative they end up doing. Stock buyback at least is a more efficient way. What's so bad about stock buybacks?
So I would argue the dividend is the much preferable way. If you want to have a regular return to your shareholders of the money, of the profit you have generated, that is part of a healthy functioning capitalist system.
I mean, stock buyback is an alternative way than a dividend because it's much more tax efficient for the shareholders. Dividend you have to pay taxes on, whereas the stock buyback, you don't pay taxes or you elect when you want to sell and then you pay the taxes. So,
but that's just a distortion of our tax code, which we should get rid of. It drives me nuts when people say like, well, there's nothing wrong with buybacks. It's just the same as dividends. You say like, well, cool, then let's ban buybacks and everyone can do dividends. And then they go, oh, no, don't do that. It's like, ah, well, clearly there is something different about buyback.
Yeah. Let's say your company, you think your shares are undervalued. Let's say you started a publishing house with a buddy and then your buddy doesn't want to do it anymore. Why can't you buy his shares? You buy the shares out from him. Does he have to go sell them to somebody else? Why can't he sell them back to the company?
Well, okay. So the example of liquidating a partnership through a buyout of one partner by the other, I think is totally different from a public market stock buyback. I think the problem, and this connects back to the effective altruism point, is that in any specific case with a stock buyback, you can say like, well, this particular company truly had nothing else to do with the money. At the same time, the entire premise of capitalism is that capital, shareholders, executives, corporations are going to think of productive things to do with capital. And if what you're saying is like, well, actually, no, I can't. Fine. If you're in a dying industry or whatever else, there are absolutely places where it's basically time to wind down a company. Problem in the US today is that that's not what buybacks are doing. I mean, the funniest thing was right after, I think it was GM, resolved its negotiation with UAW, and we're doing a $10 billion share buyback. And it's like, right as they're complaining, like, oh, we're struggling in the electric vehicle space, you can say like, well, GM is simply a failed company that will never be good at anything. But you can't tell me that like an auto company at this moment in time has no good uses for capital. That's obviously not true.
I certainly agree with you that if you're a public company, going in debt to do a share buyback seems like a crazy thing. And you've seen some of those where some of these companies end up going bankrupt because they went in too much debt to do share buybacks and stuff like that. Just seems like a crazy thing to do.
The corporate sector as a whole, I mean, buybacks reached that level for the entire corporate sector in the last decade. You have the corporate sector returning, you know, more than $1 trillion a year. And the defense of this as part of an efficient economy is, well, good, it will then reach some more efficient use. And that's not something you can just assume. Well, who are the people out there who are going to take this capital and find something more efficient to do with it? And this is all a digression from the effective altruist point, which is saying like, well, I'm just going to be the guy who goes and earns a lot of money. And by the way, like enjoys all the perks of that lifestyle, but then like trusts that someone else will take this money and actually do something useful with it. Just not cool. And so my advice, in contrast to both what I see as the sort of two wrong paths, is just be useful in charting your life's course. Be useful and don't trust some market value of how much money you've earned as in any way an approximation of whether or not you've been useful, because it's not. Go actually be useful and you will be, I think, happier than the people who simply follow their dreams, and you will be more useful than the effective altruists. And so that seems like a good place to be.
All right. Thank you, Oren Kass, another Oren, for joining us in World of Das. I follow you at Oren_Kass on Twitter, and I definitely encourage our listeners to engage with you there. This has been a lot of fun.
I was about to say this was a lot of fun, so thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, consider rating this podcast and leaving a review. For more World of Das, and Das is DAAS, you can subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or anywhere you get your podcasts. And also check out YouTube for videos. You can find me at Twitter at Oren, that's AUREN, Oren, and we'd love to hear from you. World of Das is brought to you by Safegraph. Safegraph is geospatial data for physical places. Check it out at safegraph.com. And by Flex Capital. Flex Capital invests in data companies like those we talk about at World of Das. Check it out at flexcapital.com.